Welcome to What's Good Miami. We are here for the next edition of Miami Minds with the James Beard Award-winning chef, Michael Schwartz, and my North Beach neighbor. It's incredible to have you, Michael. You know, I've been an admirer of your work, and I've been honored enough to build a relationship with you over the last few years and to be the receiver of delicious cookies during COVID and some espresso and a lot of other really delicious stuff.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you, man. It's good to have you. Well, I thought there was nobody really I could have a more honest and learned conversation about Miami food and hospitality than I guess I would consider you the elder statesman here.
For many reasons.
For many reasons. But you are. You're the elder statesman, and you are probably the precursor to what I think is a major, major word that is used throughout culture and millennial culture and Gen Z culture, which is genuine and authenticity, being genuine and authentic.
Yeah, I thought that was an important word back in the early days before opening Michael's Genuine, you know. And for me, it was like, you know, what are you going to call your restaurant? Because I was like, I don't know. Whatever, it was like, call it Michael's. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Michael. So we tried to come up with a word that would sort of, you know, inform people about what our intentions were. And that word just resonated with me. And then certainly, I guess, resonated with public and, you know, paired with what we actually did in the restaurant, which we tried to believe was genuine and authentic.
It's really unusual because I feel like in moments in time, like everyone has in their career, if you're lucky enough, moments in time, right? And whatever happened with, and it continues to happen, but with that original Michael's Genuine at that moment in time, not to jump the gun here, but that was a real thing. Like I was not living here when you first opened that restaurant, and everyone in the culinary world knew about that restaurant and the word.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because, I mean, I had no idea, you know. I think a lot of it is sort of the convergence of all the things at the same time and some luck, you know, and being in the right place at the right time and then doing the work, you know, and walking the walk. But, I remember when Frank Bruni from the New York Times came and he gave us a great review, and he included us in a roundup of the 10 best new restaurants around the country.
Amazing.
It was awesome. And it was like a 4-week countdown. And I think we landed at number 3. And it was amazing. And it really catapulted Michael's Genuine. But he ripped the name.
He did?
In the piece. He was like, as if, would it be disingenuous food? You know, the use of it, and it was on T-shirts and free for pretense. And so, but it worked out, you know, and I think it's important. It still is for us and our company and everything that we think about and do, whether it's, you know, for community or charity or for our employees or, you know, the product that we put, how we approach working with product is always about, is it genuine and is it authentic?
So when I was younger, I wanted to be a chef, and I did a culinary stage at the original Spago under Wolfgang Puck when I was like 17 years old on Sunset. It was an amazing experience. And then I went to work for Drew and Michael Bonides at Tribeca Grill. And I remember like those days, and it's, I guess maybe, I don't know if I call it analog versus digital restaurant days, but we were definitely taking reservations in a book.
Oh yeah,
With pencil, and there was a system. Like Drew had like some well-known system of what you need to circle and this and that, right?
That's lost now. I mean, it's open table or reza, and it was computerized, but that was art.
So that's what I was going to bring up, because I remember even the smells of those times. And like, I remember getting off the subway, walking to Tribeca Grill, and you're being in New York and you're seeing the foods be delivered on the side of the street and the different, yeah, I remember seeing, like, learning the names of the different trucks that were coming from all the different companies. And it was almost like the opening scene of like Wall Street or something, where you saw the steam coming out of the floor and this thing. And I believe that your restaurant, Michael's Genuine, and like the hospitality that you provide is one of the few places that exists currently in Miami that I would say harkens to this kind of pre-digital hospitality, like a different version of a restaurant where it was, you know, it, like I hate to, like, I remember the first time I tried chocolate, molten chocolate cake at Vong. And yeah, and like totally like knocked my socks off. But there was a different art to restaurants then than there are now. Now it's like almost like a large corporate type of situation.
Yeah.
There are exceptions. I think like a Boya Days is an exception. It's still small and intimate. But
interesting, because I think operating a restaurant now is completely different than it used to be, and way more complicated. Thus, you know, process and procedures and systems and all of those things are much more important, including profitability, because
yeah,
everything's more expensive and being compliant is much more difficult. So I think, you know, the natural progression is that smarter people had to come in and start restaurants. You know, they would kill somebody or lose money or, you know, some bad things would happen. And so, but I agree with you. I love that that analogy with analog and digital. And that's, you know, that analog vibe is what got me interested as a kid in the restaurants, you know, and I was exposed to it at an early age when I was, I don't know, 15. I went to work as a busboy in a very fancy northern Italian restaurant in Philly where I grew up. And
what was it called?
DeLulo's. And it was very cutting edge for the time, very Milan-esque. Plush green carpet, chrome and mirrors, and they had like a glass enclosed pasta room.
Oh, wow.
So that old Italian ladies that didn't speak English were making, you know, cappelletti and agnolotti, and everything was made fresh, and they were using cutting edge ingredients, which now seem to be very common, right? It's like radicchio or...
I remember the first time I had prosciutto.
Yeah.
I still, like, it was a religious experience.
And I was hooked, you know, and like you said, you know, the smells and sounds and energy that the restaurant provided hooked me at an early age. So, you know, to your point about Michael's Genuine sort of representing that era, it's just because that's the era that I'm from.
Yeah, but it's not, you don't go there and say Michael's Genuine is a Asian fusion restaurant or a Korean steakhouse or whatever it is. Michael's Genuine is just a really good restaurant.
Yeah.
Right? And so whether you're having, you know, the potato chips with the onion dip, there's some liver dish I have at like one of the bar snacks. I think it's a liver dish, right? Yeah, I love that. The chicken liver crostini or the tuna carpaccio, whatever it is.
Pretty much eat around the world.
Yeah, it's
where it gets labeled as fusion. That's true.
So you had restaurants like Gramercy Tavern and Union Square Cafe and Spago and like other restaurants like this and Alice Waters in San Francisco. All these restaurants that kind of represented a certain time period of hospitality where you were going to get a food that was a cut above by a chef who was present in the restaurant. And it wasn't really theatrical, in my opinion. It was more about the moment in that place. It was like the clubhouse in a way.
It was less bussy, less pretentious.
Yeah.
You know, look, I admired in those restaurants, all of those restaurants, like you mentioned, were North Stars for me. I either worked in them, staged in them, or studied them, you know.
Yeah.
A lot. I too worked for Wolfgang Puck at Chinois, not at Spock, but spent plenty of time at the original Spock. And those restaurants inspire, you know. And look, a lot of what we do at Michael's Genuine is driven by my early introduction to the restaurant, and maybe that's why it still feels sort of less corporate and more relaxed. I would say
it feels personal.
That was important for me.
It feels personal,
you know, and especially so we just celebrated 18 years.
That's wild.
When we opened 18 years ago, you know, we tried, like, in the beginning I couldn't afford Tatum Claus, so we had white butcher paper, crappy tables, and we tried all kinds of, like, sort of, you know, different vibes. But I wanted to create a restaurant that people could be themselves. Music was playing. It wasn't a hush restaurant, but the food was important. Not the most important thing. It wasn't every time all about the food. It was about the experience and how what you heard and what you smelled or what you saw. And then the food had to be good too. Service had to be personable. We wanted people to convey their personalities. Sure, know the, be able to answer questions, know how to sell wine, and know hospitality, but to let their personality shine. And, you know, I mean, we've had some characters there over the years, you know, face tattoos, dyed hair, it doesn't matter. As long as you're passionate about hospitality and you're professional, then you're for us.
So why do you think, so what year did it open? 2007 or something? 2007, like, so that's like right before crash.
Yep.
That must have been pretty scary.
We opened, we had some traction. By the time the crash came, I feel like we did pretty good through that period because we were sort of comfort and our prices weren't gouging. Mm-hmm. And it was a place where you felt you wanted to see people and be comfort for whatever reason. And so we sort of thrived over that period of time.
It's pretty amazing.
It was good timing. Yeah, it was like a thing. And so the that market crash didn't really have a huge impact, you know. And then Miami is Miami, and it's always Tefla. Goes through the same process that the rest of the country does, but somehow it just sort of floats above.
Yeah. When people, I was saying that I was so happy last week when the tariff thing was going on that I lived in Miami and not New York. Because anywhere you were in New York, you would have had to deal with that. Miami, like, no one's actually really paying attention. Yeah. Like, it'll work itself out.
Exactly.
So just to go back to the beginning here quickly, because we didn't do the like normal intro. What's your name? What do you do?
This is Michael Schwartz, and I'm a chef.
You're a chef. And how long have you lived in Miami?
31 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And so can you give us like the little bit of the story? Like, hey, my biography. If you just the little one, like the real one.
I will. I'll give you the quick one. Moved here in 94.
Okay. That was a great time to move here.
Yep. It was South Beach. It was popular.
Yeah. 97 was Delano. So
it was all about the, you know, the flash of Miami Beach and South Beach. And I saw it as an opportunity to, you know, offer some more legitimate food and hospitality and not just be like a club strong.
Yeah.
I call it. And so I moved here in 94, opened Nemo in 95.
Okay.
My ex-partner Miles, who still has
Prime 112. Okay.
Yeah, he runs all those restaurants.
So that was south of 5th, Nemo?
Yeah, first the Collins.
Oh, that's
now Motec.
Ah, yeah. So it was Prime Fish after?
After, yeah. It was many things after Nemo. Nemo was the sort of the spot.
Yeah.
In the mid-90s. And, you know, it opened in the Nemo, was the Nemo Hotel. First kosher hotel in South Beach.
Oh, wow.
And it had great bones. And we opened there in 95. To great success. No, and I think that what we did sort of resonated, not unlike what I do on Michael's Genuine.
Okay.
More about substance and less about flash. But we captured all, you know, Michelle Pommier had a modeling agency around the corner, like Miami was pop. And we had success and we opened some more restaurants together. We opened Big Pink and we opened the sushi bar and we.
So you guys were involved in that together? I had no idea.
Yeah. And then we split in, I'm going to say 2002, 2003. Then he went on to open Prime and sort of solidify his
legacy.
And his legacy. I, you know, in between that time and opening Michael's Genuine, sort of floundered around, took some weird jobs.
Okay.
I'd rather forget about. But in 2007, opened Michael's Genuine.
So how did that come about?
So for me, it was sort of a last ditch effort. I was going to open a restaurant and give it my best or leave town with my tail between my legs. You know, I had kids, you had young kids.
Yeah.
And it was a Hail Mary. And
that's all the best work gets done.
I want exactly under pressure.
Right.
You know, and I wanted to open a restaurant that, you know, expressed my personality. And I found the design district was
close in proximity to South Beach, but then had surrounding neighborhoods and easy to access off I-95.
By better rents too?
Way better rent. And so I opened it. And
was it Craig involved at that time?
Craig's not by Lambert.
Oh, he isn't. Okay.
Yeah, it's one of the few buildings he doesn't. But Craig's been awesome and super supportive. It still is over the years. And what the design district turned into was incredible. And I never, you know, had any IKEA.
But you're inevitably like connected to it. Because if you're going to even like, obviously I did my pre-interview research, even though I know you, and it does, it's synonymous. Michael's Genuine, design district, Michael's Genuine.
I think we put the design district on the map, and Craig obviously then took it to the next level.
Yeah.
When he partnered with LVMH, and then it exploded and it changed.
Was MC Kitchen already there or no?
So MC Kitchen, when I opened though, there was nothing there.
There was nothing.
Before I opened, there was a restaurant on 40th Street called Piccadilly. And it's across from where Big Face Coffee is now, at a
yeah.
key spot that later became Pacific Time, and then the River Oyster Bar guy opened there, and now it's been empty. But there was nothing there. Senora Martinez, who Michelle he opened on the corner where the Patek Philippe store is.
Yeah. That was Senora Martinez?
Yeah, that was Senora.
And she had a little place, right? Like a coffee place or something?
Yeah, I forget the name of it.
Yeah.
But there was like little stuff like that happen.
Right.
And I liked it. And I felt like it was accessible. But I'll tell you, when I opened... During the day, there was activity. There's people shopping for designer showroom stuff. But at night, it was a ghost town and a bad neighborhood.
Yeah.
Had to send the people out in groups to go to their car. And there was muggings.
Oh, wow.
Theft and all that stuff. But it worked out. And then after that, there was opportunity that presented itself. We opened Michael's Genuine in Grand Cayman. We opened Harry's Pizzeria on the street. We did a partnership with Royal Caribbean where we were on 6 of their cruise ships. So I spent way too much time on the cruise ship. Not my favorite thing, but a great partnership with them. Partnerships with SLS Hotels where we did roll out of a concept called Philia, which I don't think is even around anymore. Cypress Room was another one. That just reacting to opportunities.
Yeah.
And, you know, built a brand. I didn't know anything about what a brand was, but wound up building a brand and capitalizing on some opportunities. We expanded the pizzerias, morphed it into Genuine Pizza, which was a failure. And then
Genuine Pizza and back to Harry's Pizza. So what was that all about?
Yeah, it was an opportunity to expand,
No, but Harry's your son, right?
So Harry is my son and my grandfather. When we expanded the pizzeria thing, we opened a Coconut Grove, second Harry's location.
Which is still there.
Very successful. And at that time had great margins. And we were like, let's do more of those. And we thought it was a good idea to leverage the Genuine name.
Oh.
So we morphed it to Genuine Pizza and did a little rollout, raised some money, started a separate company. It was interesting and learned a lot.
And then you went back to Harry's Pizza.
Ultimately, we.
But you have a couple locations at Harry's Pizza still, too.
I think delivery service disrupted that segment. It's like adult pizza, grown-up pizza, a little more expensive.
Yeah.
Delivery, cuts into that, and the margins just shrunk.
Really?
Over the years, yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting.
22%, and now you're lucky if it's in
Because the delivery service partners take, 25-30%, right?
They take, and then, cost of goods, cost of labor.
So let me ask you a question, because I sense your internal struggle with some of the world of restaurants and food. Not at all in a negative way. I mean,
totally negative.
I don't mean it that way. I just sense a love-hate relationship.
Well, look, I've been in this business for 45 years, and it's changed, and it's difficult, and maybe it was always difficult, but to me, it seems more difficult now, and Miami's changed, And in a lot of ways for the better and a lot of ways for the worse, you know. And I, through the 30 years that I've been here, I've seen these, you know, changes, waves of change,
waves of people from around the country coming and opening restaurants.
And an influx of people that leave. And so these waves, but, you know, by far, this is the biggest wave post-COVID. Yeah. But it's really just bigger, but it's the same, you know. And so what I mean by that is in the restaurant scene in general here, it's the same.
There's just more. So there's more young chefs doing good work, and there's more tool bags that, you know, think they want to prove how to run a restaurant by app, right? Yeah.
And it's just the same as it was 30 years ago. You know, it's just there's more, and it's saturated to the point where, you know, the pie didn't get much bigger.
Yeah. It did for a minute. It
did for a minute.
Like 23, right? Or 22?
22 was a bull.
Yeah.
You know, if we copy and paste 22, all great. And for everybody. But the pie didn't get bigger, but the pieces, you know, there's more pieces.
So, you know, I don't know how people come, you know, like I was an outsider. I was a New Yorker that came from Philly. I moved to New York. I came to Miami and opened a restaurant. And I think that I did it right in that I reached out to the community. I tried it.
You feel Miami. People would say Michael is Miami. They don't say Michael's Philly. Right.
But in the beginning, you could have criticized me for being cocky about what I know about.
Yeah, of course. You wouldn't be a chef.
There's a way, I think, to integrate into a community. And some people do and some people don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, I just don't understand how you come and put $20 million into a build out. First of all.
Which is crazy in general. I don't know. I mean, it's got to be like some Miami Cocaine Cowboys, man.
Blow up the pay scale, blow up the labor ski pool, and say, I'm going to teach, you know, and then 2 years later, they're pushed.
And by the way, they're not stopping, though. There's got to be at least 10, $20 million restaurants in the pipeline.
I was going to say six more, but there probably are 10. There's more and more coming. And so I just don't know how sustainable that is, you know.
I don't think it is sustainable.
But, you know, like I said before.
But it hurts everyone else every time it gets done, right?
It never bursts. It does. I just don't get it. But so, you know, I love my app.
But couldn't that be like an incredible opportunity for someone like you?
In what way?
Well, if there's going to, as a businessman, more, right? You're going to see all this money's coming into all these restaurants. There's definitely going to be at least half of them fail, probably more. And then they need the name. They need Michael Schwartz.
Second generation.
Right? They need someone who knows how to operate, who has a name. Yeah. The landlord can't let sit on that.
Well, let's see how it plays out. And for our company, post-COVID, we've been sitting on the sidelines, thankfully. It gave us an opportunity to dial in our process of our operation, how we care for our employees, and how we give back to the community. And watched, you know, dozens and dozens of restaurants open and not proportionately enough restaurants close. And so we'll see how it plays out. You know, I'm always down for opportunity, but it's interesting. It's an interesting.
So just to like formalize this though, I want to like give people an understanding of what's truly happening here. So you have inflation, right? Inflation brings up the cost of ingredients. Right? Inflation brings up the cost of ingredients, but also then the cost of labor, because the people who work in your restaurant need to afford living in an inflationary period, right? So they need more money. So it costs more money labor. Labor is the most expensive part of the game, right?
You get an out-of-towner that comes and blows up the pay scale by paying a line cook $24 an hour.
Yeah.
So then you got to meet that, right?
Or else he's going to leave, and then you have to teach someone else. Which is going to cost you more.
Turnover kills you.
Right?
Yeah. So all those things.
And then the real estate becomes more expensive eventually, right? Because they want more money because everything's more expensive for them.
That's right. So then what happens?
People go out of business. Yeah.
And if you're even a...
And the margins are bad or are tough already in a fine dining restaurant.
Always tough.
Right.
You know, and then people complain that you charge too much.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I don't know where, like, I don't know what the end...
You don't know where it stops.
Because prices aren't going to come down.
Yeah.
Stabilize. Then as cost of living, you know...
So people need to get used to a new normal.
I guess. You know, look, the new normal is you order a freaking wrap from a delivery service and it's $24. If you're lucky.
Well, this was a funny thing someone told me. You know, obviously there's the general, like, dialogue about Pure Vita being expensive, right? Yeah, Pure Vita is an expensive cafe. Or at least I used to think it was expensive. Now, one day I'm super hungry and I'm driving home to my house and there's a Subway on the side and I had to stop. I really wanted a sandwich, whatever. It is what it is, right? So same order, turkey on whole wheat with honey mustard, banana peppers, pickles, lettuce, oil, vinegar, salt, pepper. I recommend it. And it's not a bad one. Okay? With the chips and a drink. And I go to check out. And I remember when I was in high school, I used to get the same exact order, right? And it was like $6, $5, $6. It was, and people complain that a Pure Vita wrap is, let's say, $19.95 or something. It was like $17.95 for a Subway sandwich.
Okay.
So I was like, that's wild.
So that's insane. I didn't to mention any name during this interview, but there are places, you know, Pure Vita, great. Like, they're killing it.
Yeah, they're doing amazing.
I just had a Pure Vita juice this morning because it was right next to my physical therapist and it was $12.
Yeah, yeah.
A little pressed juice that was probably made 3 weeks ago somewhere. But,
for me, I've always been like, I used to be known as the consumer crusader. I was Ralph Nader. Okay. Because I was always fighting to keep... People aren't even going to know who the fuck Ralph Nader.
Some people might.
But I was always fighting to keep prices down because I wanted to be the place that people went to all the time. And I look at some of the prices now that I'm charging. I can't even believe it. Yeah. You know, but it's not like our margins grow. We're just trying to maintain our margins so that we can make a living. Yeah. And everything's more expensive. So I don't know where it goes, really. And I don't know how someone spends $20 million on a build-out, even if they do $20 million a year. How do you pay that back?
I don't know.
Well, if you look at the margin, it's 10%. Okay, so that's going to take 10 years to pay that.
Yeah, yeah, which is not a good use of capital.
So I don't know. Maybe it's...
I don't know, man. I don't know. I do have faith in always in the human condition. I think the one thing we have as humans is we always tend to figure it out. We always figure it out, but it's a real problem. It's a real issue because there's only so much the consumer can take. And like, I remember you used to go out like a big night out, let's say with your, you know, let's say your wife for dinner or something like that. You'd like $100, $120 a person was like, that was a lot of money. And that was like, you were eating good. That's like, it's a minimum 200 a person now. And it's wild. And like, if you get, God forbid, you should want a steak.
Well, I mean, you know,
a good steak.
I have kids that live in New York, one in New York, one in Chicago. And you know, I subsidize their living, I guess, to an extent, but
yeah,
they're making ends meet on wages that I just don't understand how they even do it, you know, but
there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah. You want to be in New York, you figure it out.
Yeah. I used to have an infatuation with New York. I never thought I would leave. I mean, I lived in New York for 38 years, but I don't feel the same way about New York anymore as I used to. I mean, it's still an amazing, you could get anything you want anywhere, but like from a lifestyle perspective, I don't think it could even compare to what, yeah, I'm an old man.
I mean, our priorities change. I still love New York.
Yeah? Do you go often?
I'm there 4, 5, 6 times a year.
Have you had any great meals there recently?
Always.
Anything worth noting?
I mean, for me, like, it's funny. Like, Frenchette is one of my favorite restaurants. And also, have you been to Four Horsemen?
No, I've never heard of Four Horsemen. Frenchette, I've heard of.
Go to Four Doors.
Okay.
And it's a wine bar. There's no alcohol, cocktails.
Yeah.
but the feed is exceptional. And they do it right. It's small and you wait.
Where is it?
Williamsburg area, I think. Hard to get a reservation, small room, but just outstanding. But, you know, all there's always the right. And my daughter's totally dialed into the scenes.
I try to go out. There's always new places, but I had a list. I'll send it.
She's a food person?
She loves food. Yeah.
Amazing. I remember, actually, like, so why'd you move to North Beach?
Love North Beach. You know,
And I remember when you sold your house on Miami Beach, because I remember seeing the listing and a beautiful kitchen.
Kitchen was amazing.
Yeah.
We had a divorce and we sold our house. But it was my dream kitchen.
Oh, yeah. It was a really beautiful kitchen.
An addition. So I had like a galley kitchen in that house. It was a 1950s house that was owned, was built by the former mayor of Miami Beach. And then Michelle Oka Doner lived there. You know who she is?
No.
She's an artist. You know, in the Miami airport, the ocean.
Yes.
Seaweed floor.
Yes. Oh, cool.
The gray roof. But it was a galley kitchen. And we had this big screened-in floor room. And my friend, who's an architect and designer, is like, let's put the kitchen there. I was like, oh, yeah, great. Let's do that. It turned out to be like an addition. All the structure, steel beams, all the plumbing. But it was amazing. It was about a 1,300 square foot kitchen.
It was a beautiful kitchen.
Wood burning.
I think it sold before I ever had a chance to go look at it.
I always have lived in Miami Beach almost the whole time, exclusively that I lived here. Except for a few years post-divorce through that and over COVID. And I wanted to be back on the beach. And I found North Beach. You know, I'd spent some time up there. The band shell's up there.
Yeah.
And I found a great place. And it turns out it's great. It's like, feels like a little beach community. And, you know, there's a lot of development on the horizon. And Ocean Terrace looks like it's about done. And there'll be some development there. But right now... I love it, and I love being, you know, on the beach.
I think it would be a perfect place for like a.
You should open.
You should open a restaurant there. If you just had a little spot with really good food, I feel like that's the only thing missing from the neighborhood.
Spot out there.
What do you got?
Ask you if you've been there. The Wrapper.
The Wrapper is the Lebanese. So I've seen them on social. Actually, Alex has been there.
You got it.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. You're welcome. Go to the Wrapper.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
It's good. I'm definitely going to check it out.
Super solid.
Amazing. They're really passionate about it.
There's not a ton of...
Blossom's not bad.
It's fine.
Blossom's not bad. The guy George has 3 restaurants up there. He's like taking the neighborhood.
Saison.
Yeah.
Burgers.
Burgers is into it. So I don't go to any of those, but they're very popular.
Yeah.
I heard Misnon is opening. Up there.
I heard Roberta.
And Roberta's is opening up there. Have you ever been to Silver Lake Bistro? I heard they have a good burger. Yeah. There's something going on up there. I mean, I love it. I love being there.
Yeah. Same.
I really do.
Same. You know, I like that there's growth there. You know, I want to see more people and not too many, but.
So you said before that some things changed for the better and some things changed for the worse.
Yeah.
What changed for the better?
Shit. you know, there's more. Yeah, what did change for the better?
What changed for the better? In Miami? Okay, we'll come back to that.
Hey, listen, I'm still here. So, you know, I love Miami. It's my home. I raise kids here. Our family, businesses. There's plenty of good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing place.
So for me, it's the resources and the fish, the product that we get.
So what do we get here that other people don't get? Because when I first moved here, I was like, you know, in a way, like I had probably deluded myself into thinking I was getting the bounty of California, which clearly we do not have.
Not even close. Not even close.
Yeah.
It's totally different. And it took me a long time to sort of accept that too.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, you know, it's a peninsula, right? So there's always stuff coming from like a limited area. Yeah. And it's tropical, subtropical. Mm-hmm. So as you know, the growing season's upside down. We're coming out of our peak growing season now, which is finished. Strawberry, easy.
tomatoes are going to end. And then we go into the summer where it's hot and buggy and it's supposed to be tropical fruits. But there's no big berry here. So we're not in a lot of cheeses. We're in a subtropical climate, so we don't get things like artichokes and asparagus and crops like that. And then, you know, sort of cattle and lamb and goat, not a ton. Northern Florida, there's a good amount of cattle that then gets shipped off to Nebraska or someplace to finish it on grade or what, sell it. But the big win is the seed for me. And
well, I think that would be considered obvious, right? Okay.
But people, you know, look, and that's another thing that bugs the shit out. Like, we're in some of the best seafood, I think, in the country, if not the world.
Yeah, when people are flying in Dover soles.
Right. And, you know, like, tilefish, pompano, king mackerel, and Spanish mackerel, grouper, snapper, stone crabs, golden crab, you like, the list goes on. Oysters, clams, squid, octopus,
shrimp.
So you have all that here?
You have all that here. We try to use as much of that. Look, I mean, my brain muscle's in from Maine and other product from other parts. But mostly we try to focus on local, particularly Finnish, because it's so alert there.
Amazing. So what's your morning routine?
Morning routine is usually I get up around 6, espresso,
genuine panther roast. So panther mix, I know you, sorry.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
I want to try it. But panther, you know, we've been partners with panther for a long time. And over the years, I asked Joel from panther to develop a special blend for us.
Yeah, I've had it. It's delicious.
Kind of roasted a little bit darker, which he didn't want to do.
He's not big on it. He likes the bitterness, I think, usually. Like
laurel kind.
Yeah. Yours is more Italian, it feels.
Sure.
Yeah.
So it's a double espresso, a walk up around the park with the dog, and then a workout. And then I'm usually on the road by 9 to go to, you know, the restaurants.
Breakfast?
Usually it's like yogurt with berries and seeds or something, or a smoothie or a protein thing.
How do you keep it? You keep the weight off as a chef?
By eating less. So eating less and exercising. And as you get older, it's both. And it's really mostly eating less. And, you know.
But you have to taste a lot, right? Less so now, right?
Honestly, I'm not like in the kitchen.
Yeah.
I taste and I love to eat. So keeping weight off or getting it off is harder as you get older and harder than my business for sure. You know, but I've had ups and downs. You know, I think in my 40s, I was pretty heavy and didn't feel good and was busy, you know, being a chef and raising the family. And I hit 50 and I was like, this is not, you know, cool.
It'll kill you, man.
And yeah, and so I'll be 61 next.
Being a chef is not an easy.
No, it's hard on your body. My body is just like broken.
Yeah. I was sad to see that the chef from New York who passed, James, I think, James, he was a good chef, man. And he was young. And he didn't look old. Like,
I don't know, man. The business takes its toll on you, I think, physically and mentally. You know, so I think trying to, you know, if you stay in shape physically, it helps your mental capacity, I think.
Do you think there's, like, misconceptions about being a chef?
Oh, yeah, tons.
Like, what?
You know, like,
dang.
I mean, you know.
Well, I would think that people probably think, wow, that Michael is living a glamorous life, right?
Never trust that skinny chef to say that I'm skinny, but, you know, misconceptions, sure, that we eat only the finest foods all the time, you know, or that, you know, it's very glamorous. And I mean, it's hard. It's a hard job. It's a hard business. And anyone that thinks they want to do it, that's not 100% sure or passionate about it, should do it. It'll break you, you know. And for me, even, you know, I think at some point you're neglecting something. If you're working 70, 80, 90 hours a week, everything else is suffering. So for me, it was family, my kids, you know, my marriage, for and in my health. And so tried to figure it out and, you know, try to stave off, you know, old age and body ailments and shit breaking down, you know, but it's about a balance, eating, exercise and moving your body, you know, try to stay young.
What is your best memory of being a chef? Like, what is your highest high?
I mean, winning the Beard Award, I think was the best for me. And it's like, so it was long ago. It was 15 years ago.
Why, is it because of your peers, like, recognizing you? What is it about it?
And I really think, like, even that prestige has changed.
Yeah. You know,
I think the Beard went through some changes, and even Michelin, and I think recognition in general has shifted since social media became so.
Well, truth has shifted.
Yep.
So it's hard to have recognition if you don't have truth. And like, if people that, like, we're in a crisis of truth.
Yeah.
So, and for anyone to be the best, I could make someone the best as a marketer.
Yeah.
Just give me 6 months and a good social media account.
And yeah. It's like the best of the best. So, but that was a proud moment for me. And I never tailored my career around winning awards. You know, and I remember a good friend of mine was a food critic here in Miami. We raised our kids together. We're still friends. She's no longer a writer. Very smart and a dear friend. And I remember when we opened and I got nominated and she's like, yeah, but this isn't a beard award kind of place. And I've heard her up.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think at that time when I opened, sort of that style of dining was trending. It was changing from, you know, fine dining restaurants that won awards had to be a certain way.
Yeah.
And couldn't have a interesting playlist or be boisterous and loud. And I think that is when it started to shift. So I think winning that award for me was a big highlight. That was a big sort of pinnacle. And probably, you know, went to my head to the point where I thought I could chill out now. Was a rude awakening when I figured out that I still got work.
That's the Michael Jordan lesson. Never be satisfied, man. Satisfaction is a disease.
It is bad.
It is, especially if you're like really good at something. It's like, it's it.
Become complacent and then you get bypassed by it.
So what's the low?
I mean, I don't, like, there's so many ups and downs. It has to be, you know, closing all the restaurants over COVID. That's what we meant. You know, we closed 10 restaurants and laid off 450 people. That was pretty low, you know, but I think it was a different, I wouldn't say that was the low point because we had no control, you know?
No, yeah.
It wasn't a result of failure. Closing restaurants that you have control over is definitely depressing. I've done that, you know, many times, but lots of lows, I think. For me, you know, one of my favorite restaurants was the Cypress Room. And if you weren't here, that, but it was a special place. It's Jewel Box. It was in the Design District. It was a tiny little restaurant. I think it's called Pepe's now.
Oh, yeah. That's it's a tough space. Because great restaurants,
it was a
tough space.
Beautiful. I'll send you some images in that restaurant. It's like a throwback restaurant to old Miami. Crystal chandeliers, a Pecky Cypress paneling, animal heads, white tablecloth. It was a special place. Closing that was
that was tough. So, but that I'm gonna go out on a limb and say there's restaurant juju. That space seems to have some poor restaurant juju.
Yeah, and I was gonna say
like maybe you should reopen that one.
Yeah, exactly. No, I was gonna say, you know, when you consider taking over a second,
because Ghee, amazing restaurant too. I like that restaurant.
You consider taking over a second generation restaurant, you're gonna be dealing with the stigma.
Yeah.
And some restaurants are really cursed for whatever reason. I don't know.
Yeah. But I think that one has something to do with the traffic in that area. It's just like, Miami to me is a micro neighborhood place. Like one side of the street could be a different neighborhood than the other side of the street. It's wild. Like you don't open in the right, like, space. It's a weird thing here. You know?
Taking on like the
parking lot next to it.
Yeah, it's a good parking lot.
The where the overpass is. But you know that they beautified that now. It doesn't look beautiful. Beautiful to when I was there.
And people do want to park their fancy cars there. We used to have to walk people in the back door through the kitchen. We thought that was cool. I like that.
You never know. So in terms of as the elder statesman now of the Miami food scene, I would say Miami was definitely before you, and I don't want to overstate, but before you opened Michael's Genuine, Miami was definitely not known as a food place. So there were a few here and there, but definitely was kind of considered a more barren food town. I don't think, and I'm not going to knock like Cuban cuisine, but I don't necessarily consider Cuban cuisine like one of the great cuisines of the exactly. But like, it was definitely not known as a place to come for fine dining or really high end food, right? Then you open, and then now things have definitely upped a level in terms of what you can get here. Because there was points where when I first moved here, and I'm only 10, 11 years here, where like I kind of miss pre-COVID being able to just walk in a restaurant any night I want. And like usually someone taking care of me, you know, in a good way and like, you know, send me around to drinks and whatever. And to be honest, there was more like a one place a night type of thing.
Right.
Like if you were going to go out on Tuesday, you would go to this place because you knew if you wanted a little scene, you were going to go there because people were going to go there. But now you have a much more evolved scene. I mean, just the sushi alone, like there's at least 10, 15 omakases you can get here now. I don't think you could get an omakase here before COVID, really, like maybe one or two. So like, what do you see happening now in the world of restaurants and hospitality here? Obviously beyond, you know, just the stuff we discussed. Yeah, like what do you see as like, as someone who loves food and hospitality, who sees what's going on here, obviously you have your own opinions on these like big mega restaurants, but no city can really you don't become who you're going to be based on the mega tourist restaurant. Like that's not, you know.
Yeah, but in a way, it's assisted heavier.
Yeah, but you have also in like Coconut Grove, like for instance, you have like Felix and Luca, and there's some stuff going on over there. And then you have your Boya Days of the world and different stuff. There's stuff happening here.
Yeah, like I said in the beginning of the interview, there was always stuff. There's more stuff now.
There's more of everything. So there's more earnest, hardworking young chefs that are doing cool shit.
Yeah. Vice Versa has been getting a lot of attention recently now. But Sonny's is a thing?
In large part is overshadowed by these clubstrots. And Miami's party town. And I'm not mad about it. I think it's great for Miami.
I don't really go to the clubstrots, really.
Well, you're an exception. No, I mean, you know, I don't either. But plenty of people do.
What I would love to see more of is, you know, restaurants or ideas around the cultural diversity that makes Miami what it is, right? And you know, borrowing from the Caribbean or Haitian or Cuban or Latin and mixing that with the product that we have.
Sorry.
Salute. But, you know,
they rarely come in just one, so be ready. No, I'm good. Yeah.
Yeah. But where do I see it going? I don't know. Like, I think one thing that sticks out in my head right now is like that strip on Collins of all those hotels, like the Delano and SOS and Shelbourne and the Raleigh and
Short Clown.
They're all dark.
Bulgari.
Getting ready to reload.
Yeah.
The Raleigh's going to turn into the...
It's going to be a Rosewood. Shore Club's going to be a... No, Shelbourne's a proper. They're opening soon. Shore Club's going to be Auberge. Then Bulgari's opening next door.
So
Amman is opening.
Crazy. I'm really interested in seeing how bad...
Cipriani.
Like nuts. Not only the volume of hotels that are overloading, but the caliber
of what they're putting in there. So I want to see how that shapes Miami Beach.
They're not getting any Michael Genuine restaurants over there? No Michael Schwartz restaurants yet?
No one's reached out yet, but this is the time.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I think you might be getting a call.
Yeah.
I could see you getting a call.
The Raleigh that I really appreciated and enjoyed, and I love that hotel, and I hope that, you know, I hope they do that.
I used to love the breakfast at the Raleigh.
And just the vibe, you know, and that martini bar and the pool, and I just hope that they respect the history of that enough to not screw it up. And I think Rosewood does an amazing job. So I'm optimistic, as I am with Aman and Cipriani, you know. So
to me, that would mean that South Beach then becomes again a destination for locals, not just tourists. And I'd like to see that, because it seems like everything migrated over to the other side. For many years, even really since I opened Genuine.
So where do you, like, what are the neighborhoods you like to spend time in now?
My home?
North Beach.
In my apartment. It's really true. I mean, if we had our choice, you know, my lady and I would just be home. You know, but we like to eat, A, in our restaurants, and B, like to go see what's going on around town every once in a while, so...
Have you tried John and Vinny's yet?
Yeah.
I like John and Vinny's.
Yeah, we went there when they opened, and they're friends, and I like what they're doing. I'm not sure if they're staying there.
No?
They call it a residence.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I think they were hedging from the beginning, right? But I think they're doing well.
I just like the fact that that's like a, to me, it feels like an elevated neighborhood restaurant. It feels like a really, as a restaurant person, but as a restaurant person, you can... like appreciate the engineering behind the concept.
Well, those guys, that's a real expression of who those guys are.
Yeah.
And if you ever got to know them or meet them,
I've met them a few times. Their food is good. I like their food, man.
Their food is solid.
Yeah. And I just, what I always find interesting with their restaurants is, like, I just think food in California in general is very good because it's so close to the source. The product is so... Yeah.
They figured out how to reproduce it here.
They did some really good. Yeah. They kept right.
Saudi and Dubai. So they have a formula that's working, but you know, they're a transplant that I can appreciate.
Yeah, I appreciate them. So what is a hidden gem that in Miami that you think people should know about or not know about?
The rapper. Gary gave you that one.
The rapper's your hidden gem?
I mean,
we're respecting the rapper. Like, I've driven by the rapper maybe 100 times. Alex told me it was good, but I haven't tried it yet.
Yeah.
They need to work a little bit on the facade.
Yeah. No, but I excited me that. I love it. No, we never go there. We just order it.
So give me an insider's view, though. I need, like, the Michael Schwartz. I'm walking down the street. And I need to get this pastry or this sandwich or something. Give me
North Beach.
Anywhere.
Let's come back to that.
Okay, we'll come back to it. Okay.
Will we ever come back to that?
I would like to come back to that one because I think you probably have something that people really like hidden gems. And I think that you probably are underestimating what a hidden gem is. No, but a hidden gem, it could be like Marky's or something, like tacos and burritos. I love tacos and burritos. Have you been there? Amazing. You should definitely go there. It's amazing.
I used to think Wabi Sabi was a hidden gem.
Okay, Wabi Sabi could be a hidden gem. I think for the general public it is.
An expense.
It is?
Hello?
Yeah. So Wabi Sabi's a hidden gem. Where would you go get a sandwich?
No, I'm just kidding. I try not to eat.
Chevre? Would you go to Chevre?
I've never been there.
I heard they make a good sandwich too. Yeah.
Is there in the Mia Market?
They're now in the Mia Market, but they're really in Coconut Grove.
Yeah.
But if you think of one, where do you shop? Where do you get your food? Yeah.
Publix. I mean, it's right there. You know, Costco.
Yeah, I like them all.
I mean, I'm just me.
You're just a regular guy, man.
Yeah. No. You know, no secrets. I'm not a huge fan of Whole Foods.
Me neither. It's expensive. Trader Joe's I like.
Yeah, it's fun.
All right, let's do the standard questions then. Okay. What do you love most about Miami?
The water, being on the beach. And really for me, the energy the light and the cultural diversity, although sometimes it's annoying as fuck.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I like it.
But I think it makes Miami special.
Yeah. I mean, there's always action.
Yeah.
It's always something going on.
Yeah.
How do you share your creativity?
How do I share my creativity? I think through the restaurants, you know, and I think through the food and the hospitality. And, you know, I think
creativity is always evolving, you know, and it
shows itself in different ways.
You have a lot of music in your life too, right?
And all kinds of music, but I'm a huge jazz fan.
Yeah.
But creativity, you know, shows itself in different ways. And it could be through a dish or a beverage program or a point of view for a cookbook or, yeah.
And if you could give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
I think it would be find the balance, right? And I sort of hate that work-life balance term that really...
No, this is really important stuff.
Affected, I think, people's determination and drive, which affected quality of labor. But I do think it's important to find a balance, you know,
prioritize your life, right? If getting ahead in a career or excelling at a craft or an art or a sport is important to you, then make it a priority. But there's more to life than that one thing. And so I would encourage young people to just find that balance, or even to know that it's there and to appreciate it, even if you can't give it enough attention.
Can we unfold this for 1 second? Because this is a really big thing, because I hire people a lot. I have a very strong belief in what I call an integrated life, which is not easy to live. So like everything in my life revolves around my family, but that also means that when I'm working, I'm around my, like, so I'm trying to get everything working at the same time. By living in the same place, not traveling too much, like, you know, I could work for Four Seasons or something, be an executive and go fly around, but then I would never see my kids, right? Or my wife, right? And so I believe it's working, but it's hard because on the same, what I've realized is on one side, you can live this integrated life. On the other side, you can't be all there for any one thing if you're integrating your life. So like, am I ever fully with my kids or fully with my wife or fully with my work? They're probably not. So like, it's a very difficult game to play.
But how do you instill that in people that you want to work?
That's what I mean. Because then I can ask them that I want them to give 100% to the work, but I also want to see them flourish and be happy and have a balanced life. It's a very hard thing to deal with.
Integrated life for me, when I was in it, let's just go back 15 years. The integrating of life was everything in my life revolved around my work, including my fam.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to come see, if you wanted to spend time with me,
you had to come to work. Yeah, yeah.
It was broken.
It did
work ultimately. Yeah. But if I go back and say, well, what would I have done different? I don't know. Because then maybe I would have still a successful marriage, but maybe wouldn't have achieved some of the things I did professionally. And what's the trade-off? So for me, I'm happy in a relationship. I have 3 great kids that seem well-adjusted and intelligent and creative and awesome. And I have a business that's pretty good. Right. So in the end, it worked out. But, you know, the road was never
easy. But is it ever easy?
I don't know. No.
No. Maybe. I think the secret, or one of the secrets, is there's a very interesting Ferran Adrià quote where he talks about like waking up and taking on challenges every day and being happy and knowing that, like, that's what life is. It's the struggle to overcome a challenge. And there's always challenges in front of you, because even if you're playing backgammon on the beach, you're still doing something to activate your mind. So there's always something that's part of the challenge.
Let me ask you.
Yeah.
How many times a week do you wake up
and feel that key.
First thing.
So
as opposed to waking up and thinking about a problem or what you need to get done.
So when I look out and in Miami and I live near the beach now, and I see the beach and I see the sun and I see my daughter Sunshine, who's like 3 years old right now, I do feel gratitude in those moments.
You're laying in bed and you open your eyes.
When I lay in bed and open my eyes right now, I'm waking up trying to stay ahead of stuff right now. And I don't like doing that. And I don't like...
I do it exactly the same.
But I think I want to be great. I want to do great things.
You know, I hear people all the time that just, you know, wake up and are appreciative or grateful or, you know, blessed. And I'm all of those things. I appreciate my life. I'm grateful and I am blessed. But I want to be able to wake up and think about that and not what my first meeting is or...
That's true.
About reading a recap from a shit service in the restaurant and then they're... Or wonder why, you know, we're down 26% year over year on any given night or any shit like that. I mean,
yeah. But I think you make different choices at different points in your life.
Yeah.
And so at one point in your life, winning a James Beard Award was an important thing to you, right? There's certain points in your life, going to New York and being with your kids, super important to you. I remember once you called me for a donation for your son's Wynwood Rock School of Music thing. So that was important to you. I think at 61 years old, this is that you probably are in an evolving point in your life where you don't necessarily want the same things that you wanted before, and those things are evolving. Where I'm right now 45 years old and I'm trying to prove a point right now and make it so that when I'm 61, I can do what you're talking about doing. So my kids, I want to see my kids. I want to see, but my vision in my head is I will be in some sort of like middle Mediterranean town at a long table with the kids, their spouses, the kids' kids, and my wife. And if I could be there and I get there to that table and I get there, I survive, then I can sit. But right now there's work to be done. Right? As opposed to the fact that you won the James Beard Award and you've opened how many restaurants in your life?
A lot. I don't even know.
And you live on the beach.
Yeah, no.
And whether or not you're like, you're a local celebrity, probably a celebrity.
Yeah, no, I need to appreciate that every morning when I wake up.
And people come to eat your creations.
So I would tell my younger self to try to do that more.
And appreciate it more.
Yeah.
Gratitude.
Yeah. Be in the moment. Yeah. Not always thinking about the next great thing.
Amazing. That was good stuff for just now. So how did you find your success?
Pass
that question. I there's all different ways to define it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Waking up in the morning and being rated.
Okay. And if you could collaborate with any artist, entrepreneur, or creative, who would it be and why?
I saw that question. I was like, I hate those questions.
Good.
They're great.
Yeah, well, they're supposed to lead you in a direction.
As long as you didn't ask me what my favorite anything was.
No. If you could collaborate with someone, who would it be?
John Coltrane.
Okay. Why?
I mean, you know, I would just like to get into that guy's
brain a little bit, right? Yeah, he was genius. Brilliant. And I love his music.
And even the crazy far out show, to me, there was something happening in there.
Do you think you cook with like a jazz type of, like improv type of?
A lot of people say that, right? Or not about me, but in general, right? Like, I don't know if you meant it with Charlie Trotter. Or...
Yeah, yeah. I just watched the documentary.
Yeah. Becoming Charlie was?
Yeah.
Charlie was crazy. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I cook. I mean, I clay jazz when I cook.
Yeah.
And I love it. And,
but yeah, it would be him. But just understand his process a little bit, right?
Yeah.
So you ever see the movie Big Night? Love that movie. Sam Jr. Yeah. At the end of the movie, the guys are in the kitchen alone. You know, they're making the eggs, and I think it's actually Mark Anthony in the thing. Yeah, he's the busboy in the movie. So if you were sitting in the kitchen alone at the end of service, what would you cook for yourself? You had to eat.
You know, that depends on how service went, right? You know, and then older, wiser me would be like, "Don't eat, disaster."
I need to obey.
You know, really depends. For me, it's like what's happening right then. What product are we working with? What am I excited about? But usually, I lean towards like if I'm like anxious about something or stressed, then stress eating is like carby burnt pasta. If I'm in a good state, it's like grilled fish and salad and mess.
Yeah, I'm in the same place.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But I would say, like, after any service, right, you're pretty amped up. And there's definitely some tension release going on there.
It's pasta? Pasta's good. What is your go-to pasta?
I mean, the simple things. And again, it's really about, like, what ingredients are
available
or abundant at that time. But simple, like, cacio e pepe.
I was going to say cacio e pepe.
Yeah, and I have a black pepper. I
totally just white. Okay. All right, we're almost at the end here. What do you believe?
Shit. That was a good one. I skipped right over that when I saw it. I'm like, what? It's not going to ask that.
To me, what do you believe is like, you know, there's certain things you come back to again and again and again, things you like kind of felt before people started telling you what to do.
I believe you should listen to your first initial reaction to something.
Instinct.
You know, explore. Usually it takes you in a big circle, right? Mm-hmm. Test it. But then usually it comes back to that first, like, trust your intuition.
Yeah. I like that. What's your happy place?
Usually somewhere on the beach or in the water or in the kitchen. You know, and for me, like, if all I had to do was cook, that'd be my
North Beach. Michael's back in the kitchen.
No, I have a great kitchen in my apartment and cooking with my woman there, looking at the ocean. That's
amazing.
Yeah.
You have a favorite quote?
You know, I don't, there's a lot of quotes, but if you ask people that work for me, they would say, his favorite quote is, "Do you know what you're doing?" And I would always go around and just ask people and I would judge how they feel about their job or me as a boss or working in that environment by the reaction to that question.
Do you know what you're doing?
Yeah. And, you know, but it's funny because I always ask myself if I know what I'm doing. So I would say it's my favorite quote because that's just the, but it is my favorite question to ask people while they're working.
Is your kitchen like a kind place or a militant place?
It's a kind place. I think it always leaned towards that. Look, I think the world has changed, you know, and some of the shit that I dealt with as a young cook just doesn't fry, getting berated and yelled at and embarrassed. Like, and so I never tried to run my kitchens like that, but now more than ever, each camp. You know, I don't think it's effective. Look, I think everyone reacts differently to different management styles. Some people need to be pushed harder. Some people need to be coaxed and you know, sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? But we're you know, Sunil introduced this nonviolent communication book into our company. And it really is sort of the driving mantra behind how we communicate as people. And it's been really effective, I think, in our businesses, but also in your personal life. Yeah. So yeah, nonviolent communication is important. And we make every manager read it and practice it.
Yeah.
And it's effective, you know. But I sometimes forget about. No, and have never been a free.
So what do you wish for Miami?
What do I wish for Miami? I mean, it's a good one.
Like, where do you want us to go in the future? Where, what would make you feel like this is a more complete place?
It's not going to listen.
Okay, but it would be nice for the world to hear it.
Yeah, I just think more authenticity.
More genuine.
Less plastic surgery, less, you know.
Michael wants Miami to be more genuine.
Yeah. Ask it too much. I think it is.
So that's what you believe. You believe in being genuine.
I think that I live my life that way. But some people might argue that that's not always the case.
One dish. To close it out.
Like my death row meal?
I don't know if it's your death row meal. If you could have one dish, could be any dish for anywhere in the world, where is it?
See,
or it could be a meal or a dish.
But yeah, there's a bunch of favorite things.
Feel free to give us more than one if you'd like, because we're going to enjoy it either way.
There's a...
Come on, this is a good one. The last one.
First of all, the death row meal would be a big, juicy burger, right? With a really good,
like, aged cheddar, thrice cooked fries, and the last one in the morning. That's the death.
Some of the greatest bites that I've had. We were in Thailand a couple years ago, and they do, like, that spicy beef salad with, like, the toasted rice. It's like weeping tiger or something.
Last meal. You know, have you ever been to Il Latini in Florence? In Florence, there's a restaurant called Il Latini. It's definitely got to be at least like 100, 150 years old. But it's not a complicated meal. It's all like, it's Tuscan food. So you start with a ribollita, pomodoro. Then you have a few pastas. Then what's called, what's the Florentine steak? Steak Florentine, great tiramisu, like amazing prosciutto, the liver on like almost like deep fried crostini. Too long ago, probably like 15 years ago. I should go back.
Oh, pretty good.
Yeah, it's very good. It's very, very good. And down the street, there's a steak restaurant down the street called Sostanza. Which also they're like cooking the steak Florentine, but like on an open flame. It's just, honestly, everything there is like incredible. Also, honestly, I love eating California and Napa too. Like, I like being close to the ingredient.
One of my favorite places in San Francisco, Zuni Cafe.
It's very famous, Zuni Cafe.
Chicken, yeah. Oysters, go for lunch. Italy or France?
I'm definitely an Italy person. I'm half Sicilian.
Red or white?
Red. Definitely. Definitely. Although I haven't been drinking as much in recent memory, to be honest with you. But like, I think people like have realized that like, it's just not going to take you to the promised land. And I love red wine and I love a dirty martini, but like, and I love a margarita. I love all the drinks. But I definitely, my body doesn't handle it the way it used to.
Especially recovering is a little hard.
Yeah, much harder. Especially if you're not like really like in serious exercise mode all the time. If you're exercising 5-6 days a week, your body can take it in and like probably go with it. But if I'm like working it a lot and not exercising enough, the alcohol will not be tolerated. Well, it's been an honor. It's been a pleasure. I'm glad you. I think you did great. I think you did great. The most genuine man in Miami. Oh, yeah. Make Miami genuine again. I like it. You should probably make Miami. Nah. I love you, Miami. Thank you so much, Michael. You're the man. Appreciate it. See you soon.